Good morning, Mr. Cohn.
Good morning, Your Honor. If it may please the court, my name is Stephen Cohn. I'm the attorney for Mr. Richard Convertino, and with me at counsel table is my partner, David Colapinto. The lower court abused its discretion when it denied Mr. Convertino's motion for a stay under Rule 56F. Mr. Convertino met the criteria for that stay. He set forth triable facts on the major issue of the case that was uncontested. He acted diligently in trying to obtain those facts. That was uncontested, and the district court noted he had undergone a monumental effort. And but for obtaining additional time to pursue that discovery in the Eastern District of Michigan, he was unable and would be unable to obtain those facts. The district court based its ruling on a finding of futility.
Just out of curiosity, do you know why the Eastern District of Michigan hasn't decided this motion?
The Eastern District has not decided it as of today, because the moment the district court in D.C. ruled on summary judgment, the newspapers said that the court lost jurisdiction over that third-party subpoena case.
Wait, who said that?
The Detroit Free Press and the...
But why hasn't the district court in Michigan ruled?
Because they lost jurisdiction once the Eastern District of Michigan.
The Free Press? Because the Free Press said that?
Well, they filed a motion.
Who did?
The Detroit Free Press and Mr. Ashenfelter, and the court granted the motion in part. They said, we'll hold the case in abeyance.
Oh, until the district court here, until which district court?
Until there's a ruling from your court.
Oh, I see.
So the district court in Michigan.
The district court's waiting for this district court, and when this district court ruled, did the Eastern District now, has it now dismissed that case, that subpoena action?
The motion to compel proceeding was pending at the time the summary judgment was granted. The moment the summary judgment was granted, the third-party deponents moved to dismiss the proceeding.
The judge there is waiting for the outcome of this appeal.
Yes. And the district court cited to authority saying he no longer has jurisdiction over the case until this court rules. Thank you.
Got it.
The lower court in D.C. determined that it would be futile for the case to proceed. Futile is not a standard under Rule 56F. And more significantly, the district court in D.C. did not have jurisdiction over the third-party deposition proceedings in the Eastern District, and the district court in D.C. never addressed the merits of what was pending in the Eastern District. And in the Eastern District, that court never made a finding that Mr. Convertino's pursuit of that discovery was futile or would be futile, never made a finding that the arguments raised in the Eastern District were not strong.
Can I go back to this other question? I still want to understand the relationship between the two cases. So when the district court in Michigan ruled that the reporter was protected by the Fifth Amendment, right?
Yes.
Okay. What did you then renew your motion for discovery against the Free Press at that point?
We renewed the motion for discovery against the Free Press when the Fifth Amendment was sustained on Mr. Ashenfelter.
So why didn't the district court, and then how long after that were you forced to respond to the summary judgment proceeding here?
That was probably within a year period of time.
Okay, so why didn't the District Court of Michigan rule during that one-year period? Why did it?
There's no explanation.
I see.
I mean, one can speculate that for two reasons. First, the U.S. government could have filed a motion for summary judgment on numerous grounds in a Privacy Act case, lack of damages.
No, I'm just getting at this one point. So there was a period of time. I don't know what the significance of this is. I just want to understand it. There was a period of time when the district court in Michigan could have ruled on the discovery motion against the Free Press, right? Free of the district court's proceedings here, or independent of them, because there weren't any, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
And you don't know why, and that was a year, right?
It was approximately. The record couldn't be judicially noticed, but I would say approximately a year.
And that just sat. You didn't ask for the court to, you didn't ask for a status conference or?
It was well briefed. We had had a hearing on it. The court was extremely familiar with all the issues. When the Ashenfelter, when the Detroit Free Press deponents filed motions for expedited consideration, interlocutory appeals to the Sixth Circuit, they were all summarily rejected, and it just created a delay in the proceedings. The court in Michigan was fully briefed, held hearings. The Justice Department was a party to that case. They knew the issues precisely.
All right, but wasn't one reason that you didn't pursue the Free Press was it took a year, almost a year, to get Ashenfelter to his second deposition. In other words, the Eastern District denied your motion back in 08, and it wasn't until 09 that this second deposition was taken in which the Fifth Amendment privilege was raised.
That's exactly correct, Your Honor. The initial briefings in the Eastern District, Ashenfelter did not raise the Fifth Amendment, and he didn't raise it at his first deposition that he didn't show up to. What's significant about that is the government has argued that Judge Cleland in the Eastern District did not grant our motion to compel against the Detroit Free Press because that such a deposition wasn't needed, it would be unproductive, it was all the same. That's not what Judge Cleland held. His order on appendix page 182 specifically said that he was denying the motion on the Detroit Free Press contingent upon Ashenfelter's giving the deposition. His exact words are, based on the court's approval of Convertino's request to Ashenfelter and contingent upon its fulfillment, the court then said, we're not going to do the Detroit Free Press. The court also said in the Eastern District it was doing this because the potential adverse effects on news gathering activities suggest that an order should be as narrow as possible. So we did the entire proceeding on Ashenfelter, three separate depositions. He comes up with this very novel Fifth Amendment defense at the 11th hour. It's granted. We then renew our motion to the Detroit Free Press, which was specifically permitted by the judge's initial order, and that was sitting there in Detroit. In the scheduling order for discovery in D.C., it was held that even though the discovery deadlines were met, in other words, discovery cut off in D.C., discovery was permitted to continue in the Eastern District all the way through. Unfortunately, the judge never ruled. So when the summary judgment was filed by the government, they didn't file summary judgment on any other technical ground for which they could have had the Privacy Act case dismissed. And there are numerous technical grounds. They filed on one and one alone. We couldn't show who the source was. That kicked in our right to file a 56F motion, which we did in a timely manner consistent with the rules. The court knew of what was happening in Eastern District, and it's our position it would be an abuse of discretion not to let the Eastern District render those judgments.
In fact, the district court had no leeway here, given the length of time this matter had been proceeding.
finding in the fact that the reporter had invoked his privilege and the newspaper had taken the position in the Eastern District that it had nothing, that the only person who knew the source was the reporter. I'm just asking.
So the district court in D.C. had no jurisdiction to rule on any of those arguments.
No, but...
And they weren't presented to the district court here.
I understand that argument. What I'm trying to get at is whether the district court here had any leeway, not jurisdiction over the discovery matters, but just leeway, given that the reporter had invoked his privilege, and all you could do about that, once you had a final order from the Eastern District, was to appeal to the Sixth Circuit, and maybe on to the Supreme Court from there, who knows. But plus, the proceedings in the Eastern District showed that the newspaper had taken the position that only the reporter knew the source. And you acknowledge you need to know who the source is to pursue your privacy action. Is that correct?
Not precisely, Your Honor. The Detroit Free Press, initially in the motion to compel, the initial position it took was that it had the First Amendment privileges of the reporter. The Detroit Free Press could not appropriately invoke that privilege, the First Amendment privilege, if it didn't have any First Amendment-related information. And all of the First Amendment-related information related to the source. In regards to the pending issues in the Eastern District, I think the fundamental rule here even transcends Rule 56F. It's Anderson v. Liberty Lobby of the U.S. Supreme Court that says summary judgment cannot be granted until there is a full opportunity to conduct discovery. In this case, the only reason there was not a full opportunity to conduct discovery was that two different courts had jurisdiction over the discovery. The court in D.C., which was the fairly non-controversial discovery of the Department of Justice, and the court in Michigan, the highly charged and controversial discovery for a newspaper source.
All right, so when the newspaper in that letter says to you or the attorney client, then we're willing to turn over everything we have. If you'll withdraw your request to the reporter, have I read that correctly?
They may have made that, I'm not sure, but their definition of what was relevant was never agreed to. They wanted us to narrow the scope of our discovery. And these are the types of questions that are typically adjudicated by a judge. You have a deponent, a party who wants information, a court hears the arguments and issues a ruling. But for the fact that we had to bifurcate the two courts that heard this, this all would have been heard by Judge Lamberth, and before you would have been the Fifth Amendment issue and the compel motion on the Detroit Free Press. It would be a relatively procedurally simple case, and I think the application of Rule 56F would be very simple. Instead, you have this denial of Mr. Convertino's fundamental right to conduct discovery and present a claim. Rule 56F is designed to protect that right. It's extremely clear. If you don't have access to information which is material to a triable fact and the party who is seeking it was diligent, you have that opportunity. What makes this case unique is it is essentially the strength of the case, because it's all been briefed and ready for decision in the Sixth Circuit or in the Eastern District.
All right, now tell me why you couldn't, once Ashenfelter invoked the Fifth Amendment privilege and the Eastern District of Michigan said, I'm going to buy it, but I'm also going to let you come back if, because of impossibility, you cannot be complied with, and revisit the Detroit Free Press. Okay, why, while it was on track in D.C., why were you not following the Detroit Free Press, the opportunity the district judge gave you in Michigan to revisit the Detroit Free Press?
But, Your Honor, we did. The moment Mr. Ashenfelter invoked the Fifth Amendment, and the court sustained that, we immediately filed a renewed motion to compel the Detroit Free Press addressing the issues. That is the motion to the Detroit Free Press that was pending in Detroit when Judge Lamberth dismissed our case under summary judgment.
And that's what's been held in abeyance by the Eastern District.
Correct. And that's been held in abeyance where the Eastern District has recognized they no longer have jurisdiction to rule, but they'll hold it in abeyance pending the determination of this court.
Now, why is he, why is that a jurisdiction? Oh, it's jurisdictional because the subpoena there relates to the case here, which has now been dismissed.
Exactly, Your Honor.
Okay, gotcha.
It was, we
I see.
We
no, attempted. I understand. I understand. Right.
But now, I don't, yet on the timing, before Judge Lamberth granted summary judgment, why did you not renew the motion to compel with respect to the Detroit Free Press, which the Eastern District of Michigan gave you at least a yellow light to do in view of Ashenfelter's Fifth Amendment invocation?
Okay. Your Honor, we did. When we renewed the motion to compel the Detroit Free Press in Detroit, it was prior to the issuance of the summary judgment by Judge Lamberth.
Why don't you just give us the dates to help both Judge Henderson and I understand this?
And did the Eastern District...
Okay. Would that be helpful?
Yeah, but I just want to answer first, and that is, did the Eastern District hold that in abeyance?
Only after Judge Lamberth issued its ruling on summary judgment.
Okay, what,
all right, and the question...
What date did you file your motion?
The motion to renew.
To renew.
Your Honor, I can go
why
and look
why
at...
Why don't you get it? Let's just get the dates out. Could you pull them up there? Okay.
It says May 22nd, 2009.
Yes, Your Honor. I mean...
No, no, no. That's the press response to your renewed motion.
Wait a second. Okay, starting on August 28, that was when the Eastern District granted our motion to compel Ashenfelter.
Well, that's not the one we're looking
okay.
for. So after the district court sustained his Fifth Amendment right, you then filed a renewed motion.
On April 29, 2009, Ashenfelter, Mr. Convertino, renewed the motion to compel
okay,
on the Detroit
April,
Free Press.
April what?
April 29, 2009.
Now, how long did it take that? Did that then have to be briefed?
Yes. I mean, that's when we filed our motion.
When was that briefing finished?
That briefing would have been finished. It's not here on this record.
Was there an argument on the motion?
There was a status hearing on the motion.
And when was that?
That would have been in the May, June, July timeframe of
2009. 2 or 3 months after the April date?
Yes.
Okay, now when was the government's motion for summary judgment filed here?
July 12, 2010.
A year, 14 months later?
Approximately.
Okay, so what happened during those 14 months?
We completed discovery in the Department of Justice case.
No, in Detroit.
We awaited the decision of the court.
Okay. When the government filed its motion for summary judgment here, did you file anything in Michigan to advise that court that it needed to act quickly?
No, Your Honor.
Do you know why that court waited over a year? Why it didn't decide the case in the following 14 months?
We have no idea, Your Honor. As I said, I can only speculate that because it's a highly controversial issue, if the district court in D.C. dismissed the Privacy Act case...
There was no motion for summary judgment during that 14 months.
But everybody knew.
I see.
In other words, the Justice Department was participating. Everyone was talking. The court knew, the lawyers knew, everyone knew that this case was going on two separate tracks.
So you think the district court was here just sitting and thinking, you know, I'm not going to get into this because sooner or later, the district court, sooner or later, the district judge in Washington is going to have to resolve this case, which is going to determine whether I even have jurisdiction. So why should I decide this thorny issue, right?
That's speculation, but that's
where I stand.
Not only that, there's another reason, isn't there? And that is the OPR and OIG report might have identified who the source was.
There was a possibility that the continued discovery we were doing in the Justice Department case could have had the source identified. Unfortunately, all of the witnesses we deposed denied being the source. We do know, because the judge stated in response to his first order on the protective order, that the judge was very cognizant that rulings against the press on source issues should be narrow. So we don't know why the judge sat on it, but what we do know is under Rule 56F, it sets for specific procedures, time frames, and requirements for precisely this type of situation. Well, it may not be waiting for a judge to rule, but if there's an impediment on obtaining discovery that's necessary, once summary judgment is filed, then we can file for Rule 56F. Again, the government conducted extensive discovery on other Privacy Act-related issues for which, had they moved, they could have filed a dispositive motion unrelated to the source. The government made a tactical decision and went only on that issue. That's why it's unquestionable that we meet the Rule 56F test. It's material to a triable fact. We were diligent, and the evidence exists. We know it exists with Mr. Ashenfelter. It may exist direct or circumstantially with the Detroit Free Press. And we have a specific legal procedures to follow to obtain that evidence. And we have a right, not just under Rule 56F, but also under the Supreme Court decision in Liberty Lobby, to obtain that evidence before Mr. Convertino loses his substantive rights. I see my time has expired.
I have one question.
Sure.
Ashenfelter responded to the subpoena with a privilege log, and it had 108 documents, including a notation. I just want to make sure this is correct, that the Free Press will permit an author to do an unsourced article only when it's approved by the highest ranking official available. All right, and that's, and your position is that whoever told Ashenfelter, you can go with this story without a source, would probably know who the source is.
That's right, either through direct evidence or circumstantial. We also found the privilege log very important, because in looking at it, it appears as if many of those documents would also be in control of possession of the Detroit Free Press, emails, communications. And the Detroit Free Press never had to produce a privilege log because we hadn't gotten there yet. But the Detroit Free Press did invoke First Amendment journalistic protections in response to the first motion to compel. Thank you very much.
Samantha Heifetz for the United States. If the court will indulge me for a moment, I think it might be useful to walk back through the timeline, as I think that really speaks to the reasons we believe it was not an abuse of discretion for the district court judge here to decide to deny the Rule 56F motion. So in April of 2009, beginning in August 2008, as my opposing counsel did, the district court in the Eastern District of Michigan, Judge Cleland, ordered Mr. Ashenfelter to participate in a deposition and reasoned that pursuing discovery against the Detroit Free Press would be unnecessarily duplicative and therefore issued a ruling denying the motion to compel with regard to the Detroit Free Press and ordering the case closed. Then we had a series of depositions.
You left out one sentence.
And as we've always acknowledged, sorry, yes, Your Honor, he indicated in the order that it was without prejudice. There was no question that
he said specifically he would reconsider it. Right.
If it became as a function of impossibility.
Right.
Right. And so in April 2009, Judge Cleland sustained Mr. Ashenfelter's Fifth Amendment privilege. Right. At that point, Mr. Convertino filed two motions. He filed a motion for reconsideration of that Fifth Amendment ruling, and he filed a motion for renewed consideration with regard to the Detroit Free Press. Now, it was shortly thereafter, in May 2009, that here in the District of Columbia, the district judge, Judge Lambreth, adopted the proposed schedule and set a fact discovery deadline of June 1st, 2009. Okay, and that was per the party's joint request. So then in June 1st, 2009, that fact discovery deadline passes. In November 2009, and this is a date that, as the government, we think is really critical to why it was not an abuse of discretion for Judge Lambreth to issue the ruling that he did.
November 09 now?
We're in November 2009,
yeah.
And we're here in the District of Columbia.
Okay.
That's when Mr. Convertino asks the court to set a particular deadline for the motion for summary judgment filing here in the District of Columbia. So at that point, he's already sought reconsideration. He has filed the renewed motion, but he is well aware that he doesn't have those materials. But he indicates to the court to proceed with motion for summary judgment, setting a date, what ultimately becomes July 10th, or July 12th, 2010.
Okay, let me stop you. The motion for reconsideration, as well as the renewed motion to compel with respect to the Detroit Free Press that Convertino filed in the Eastern District of Michigan.
That is correct.
In the spring of 09.
April 2009, right.
What happened with that?
So in February 2010.
What happened between the time it was filed and, let's say, November of 09, nothing, right?
I don't think that, as I understand it, nothing happened between those dates. On February 2010, the District Court in Michigan ruled on the motion for reconsideration with regard to Mr. Ashenfelter's invocation of his Fifth Amendment privilege. So there were two motions filed by Mr. Convertino in April 2009, and the court did rule on one of them.
So
it ruled on, and it denied the motion for reconsideration.
The renewed motion to compel with respect to the
it has not ruled on that, and at no point did Mr. Convertino ask the court to move on that motion. So as the deadline for the government's motion for summary judgment approached, the deadline that Mr. Convertino had asked Judge Lambreth to impose, as that date came closer, Mr. Convertino neither asked Judge Lambreth here in D.C. to change those deadlines, nor did he go to Judge Cleland and file any kind of a letter there to let that court know of this
right.
imposing a deadline.
So your point here, I think, is that, look, the plaintiff brought this down on himself, right? He asked, he didn't pursue it in Michigan. He asked the district court here to set a schedule for summary judgment, right?
Her view is that, the standard here is an abuse of discretion standard.
Right, so.
And so we think it was not an abuse of discretion for Judge Lambreth to take into account those factors that you've just pointed to.
But he said, as I read his order, he said he denied this, he granted this, or denied the 56F motion because he said that it would be futile in Detroit. That's what he said. He
right.
said pursuing this in Michigan would be futile.
And this court has never indicated that a district court judge abuses its discretion.
But stick with me. The reason I ask you that question is that that doesn't have anything to do with these procedural issues you're pointing out. In other words, he didn't say, the district court didn't say, look, the plaintiffs, I set a deadline for discovery. Plaintiff asked me to. plaintiff then asked me to set a deadline for summary judgment. Those motions were now filed, and now he said he needs more time. That's not what the district court
said. What the district court did speak at length about was the fact that there had been years for discovery.
But he also said that the plaintiffs were diligent in trying to get this information, but that it would be futile and that he didn't want this pending all these years. Right? That's what he said.
Certainly the district court expressed a number of things, one of which was an interest in seeing finality to the litigation that had gone on for so many years. And the district court's futility point...
Well, let's take both those questions. You answer, you go ahead and say what you're going to say about
right.
futility.
Your Honor, I think you know the district court had a number of facts before it, had a number of pieces of information available to it. Mm-hmm. And the timing and the progression of litigation in the Eastern District of Michigan is certainly one of the things that was before the district court. But it's also relevant here that there are a number of pieces of information that Mr. Convertino would like to stress that the district court here didn't have jurisdiction to decide. But as Judge Rogers' questions got to earlier, whether or not there was jurisdiction here in D.C. to decide certain questions, it was certainly appropriate for the district judge to take the different facts into account, and those contributed to that futility determination. For example, Mr. Ashenfelter's invocation of the Fifth Amendment, there's been at no point any indication or a suggestion of a rationale for why that would be inappropriate here.
No, I'm not asking about the Fifth Amendment claim. I'm not even focusing on his argument.
Well, Mr. Convertino's brief certainly...
I'm only asking you about the question, the simple question, a straightforward question of whether of the district court's judgment that it was futile to pursue the Free Press.
And my point, Your Honor, is simply that there's much in the record to suggest that there was this futility. It wasn't simply futility with regard to the Detroit Free Press. It was also futility more generally with regard to discovery. But did the Detroit Free Press...
Counsel.
Yes, Your Honor.
Judge Tatel ask his question and quit cutting him off.
Oh, I apologize, Your Honor. I thought you were asking a question about the futility just with regard to Detroit Free Press, and I hadn't gotten to that.
That's all I was asking you when you started talking about the Fifth Amendment.
Right. And I apologize for that, Your Honor.
Asking you to talk about... His argument is, the plaintiff's argument is, look, to pursue my case here, I need to know who the source is. Right?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Okay. I can't get it anymore from the reporter. I have a pending motion against the Free Press. What facts did the district court rely on in the record to conclude that pursuing that would be futile?
And as we talk about at some length in our brief, the Judge Cleland's original order in the Eastern District of Michigan acknowledged the fact that Mr. Ashenfelter would be the most likely best representative for the Detroit Free Press. Now, the Detroit Free Press has, on multiple occasions, stated that it does not have the information that Mr. Convertino
it's
seeks.
It never said that under oath.
No, and my point, as I was
in
going
fact,
to...
And in fact, it said in response to one of his motions that if he'd narrow the subpoena, they would supply whatever they have on a number of things, including, quote, the source, if they have it.
Right, Your Honor, the first
I go
point...
Go back to my question. What facts in the record did the district court rely on the proposition that pursuing the Eastern District subpoena would be, quote, futile?
So early on in this litigation, the Detroit Free Press's counsel, Nixon Peabody, sent a letter to Mr. Convertino's counsel explaining that it had done an internal investigation and concluded that no one at the Detroit Free Press, other than Mr. Ashenfelter, had the information that he was seeking the source information.
Okay, that's one. What else?
Later, that was repeated by counsel in representations to the Eastern District of Michigan. In their response to the motion to compel, they again reiterated that they did not have the information that Mr. Convertino was seeking.
Okay, but you
now, neither of those are under oath, as Your Honor noted.
Isn't that
however... As I was trying to go to earlier,
isn't that pretty significant?
It might be significant if we were trying to determine a different question than the one presented here. But in terms of Judge Lamberth's, I'm not sure what question that would be significant for, but the one that I think it's not significant for is the question of whether or not Judge Lamberth, the district court in D.C., abused its discretion. So I think as Judge Rogers' questions went to earlier.
But let me go back. I don't mean to push you on this, but it does seem to me it's critical. You would agree that a judge abuses his or her discretion if the judge enters an order based on a reason that's unsupported in the record, right? That's an abuse of discretion.
Here.
Is that right? Just as a general matter. I'm not asking about this case. Just as a general matter, isn't that an abuse of discretion?
I think as a general matter that may be right, and that's not the case here.
So I go back to my question. Futility was his reason, and I'm asking you what the record supports, and the only thing you've given me so far is that the Detroit Free Press has said on several occasions that it doesn't have it.
So the
reason you concede that they didn't say it under oath.
The reason that I think I earlier, and I apologize for this, Your Honor, got off track in terms of directly answering your question, is that the court here didn't actually say there was just futility with regard to the Detroit Free Press. It found futility more generally. What the court said here was that Mr. Convertino isn't going to get the evidence that he needs, not only not from the Detroit Free Press, but not from anybody else. It was a broader finding of futility. And stepping back and looking at what has gone on in this litigation, going back to its start in 2004, there is strong support, and this timeline is really critical to understanding that support for the conclusion that, unfortunately, Mr. Convertino is not, that it was not an abuse of discretion by the district judge here in D.C. to conclude that there is no reason to think that Mr. Convertino is going to obtain the evidence that he seeks.
Well,
the 56F standard requires more than just speculation that the Detroit Free Press might have the information he desires. So the question was asked earlier to opposing counsel, why would we think that the Detroit Free Press has this information? And what Mr. Convertino has pointed to consistently is the fact that there was this policy. It's actually the policy of the parent newspaper that came in after the events at issue in this case. But setting that aside, a policy of obtaining approval for the use of confidential sources. But that policy has never indicated that you had to reveal who the source was. So the Detroit Free Press has consistently said that didn't mean that the editor had to know the name of the source.
Matter, so I'm clear. Counsel suggested that were this case not bifurcated, this would be a simple matter in the sense that it would all be before us where a proper Rule 56F motion had been filed and improperly denied. So the jurisdictional response, if I can put jurisdictional in quotes, was more that the district court judge didn't have, so far as we know, the same pleadings before it, and therefore should have either ordered that the district court, the Eastern District, be promptly notified of the motion for summary judgment or something like that to get the Eastern District to rule one way or another, as he would have done himself had the case been before him totally. And that didn't happen here.
That's right, Your Honor.
But something close to it happened because Lambert says we still have the escape valve is available to him if the Eastern District compels discovery and he is in fact able to obtain the information he seeks, he's free to move for reconsideration. So even Judge Lambert didn't shut the door completely as far as the futility of it. Because his last words are, I'm unwilling to prolong this litigation any longer. And that, in some instances, is, you know, a laudable objective, but
this court, when it's adjudicated, yes, Your Honor?
Are you relying on the 60B part of the opinion?
We are not. What we're relying on is this court's precedence with regard to 56F motions. You know, this court has never indicated that it was enough to merely speculate about or make conclusory allegations about one's ability to obtain.
But here we have an affidavit, all right, and they say precisely what it is they want to do and what they hope to obtain. And our cases have said that, you know, you do need a detailed affidavit. And obviously, if you don't have the information, you can't necessarily identify what precisely the information is. But certainly, just looking from our previous cases, this is a sufficient affidavit under the rule.
Well, the affidavit may be sufficient in terms of asserting a desire for certain pieces of information, but this court's decision in Messina said that it was no abuse of discretion where the movement to deny a Rule 56F motion, where the movement had only made conclusory assertions without supporting facts to justify the proposition that the discovery sought would produce the tribal fact. And here the issue...
This is not a conclusory affidavit. That's what I was focusing on.
Well, I think the part that...
Whether or not he succeeds is a different question.
The part that we would suggest is conclusory, I think, and this goes to Judge Lamberth's futility ruling, is the suggestion that Mr. Convertino is, unfortunately, ever going to obtain the information that he seeks. Like, if we step back, this case, we had a long OIG investigation that Mr. Convertino acknowledges was very thorough. He was given that report through discovery. He had the opportunity to depose the DOJ investigators and others at DOJ. It's not the case that this is a situation where there were only two pieces of discovery and he hasn't been able to obtain either. There was extensive discovery, years of discovery. And each time he ran up against the same wall of being unable to find the information that he sought. Mr. Ashenfelter.
That's because he hasn't yet been able to get his discovery against the paper.
But there's no indication in this record that the paper has the information.
What you're saying to him is, in order to get discovery, you have to prove that the paper has the information you want, which he can't get without discovery.
Well, he has to prove, he doesn't have to go that far, but he has to provide more than a conclusory assertion.
Here's what he's got. Number one, he's got the Eastern District of Michigan saying it will entertain his motion, right? That's number one. And number two, he has the simple logic of the fact that this reporter, who has conceded his source was the Justice Department, worked for the newspaper. And, I mean, we don't know the details about how the Free Press works, but it's at least, it doesn't seem to me to be particularly speculative to think that under certain circumstances, the newspaper might well know who that source is.
But what we also
why is that speculative?
Well, what we have is evidence strongly to the contrary, right? We have the pending motion before the district court for not one, as my opposing counsel indicated, but 2 years. The district court, that motion was filed in April 2009. It wasn't until the renewed motion to compel
the Free Press
was filed in April 2009. Yeah. As of July 2010, when the government complied with the motion for summary judgment deadline that Mr. Convertino had requested. 2 years had then passed.
So the district court's inaction is proof of the fact that there's no, Free Press doesn't know this.
No, Your Honor, you were simply pointing to the fact that there was this pending motion, and I would look to say that it's not the case where we're trying to cut off.
No, I didn't say that. I didn't say there was a pending motion. I said there's a district court in the Eastern District of Michigan who has said that it will entertain that motion if the Fifth Amendment claim about the reporter.
Right, and I'm just pointing to the fact that
it's not just an idle pending motion.
That the deadline suggests that the fact that the court may not do that, because we have seen orders from the court since then. February 2010, it rejected the motion for reconsideration with regard to Mr. Ashenfelter.
With respect to the reporter.
That's right, but it didn't say anything about, and then subsequently when the court ruled here, very quickly thereafter, the court there ask the parties to show cause why the case shouldn't be closed. All I'm pointing to, Your Honor, is this, making the very simple point that it does not appear that the judge in the Eastern District of Michigan is eager to rule on this motion.
Yeah.
The second point to go to your, because you...
What was your verb?
Is eager.
Not eager, you said.
That's correct. Does not appear that he is eager. So the second things that you, yeah. The first thing was the pointing to the fact that there is this motion that is before the court in Michigan. The second thing was the sort of logic of the fact that Mr. Ashenfelter worked for this newspaper. Well, on that point, you know, what we do know for a fact is that Ashenfelter's Fifth Amendment privilege was upheld. And when the court denied the motion for reconsideration of that ruling, so this is the decision that the court put out in February 2010, it talked a bit about the basis for that decision insofar as it indicated that Mr. Ashenfelter's concern Among the things he was concerned about being prosecuted for was a violation of 18 U.S.C. 641, I believe.
Okay, but let's not talk about the merits of that. Let's ask you, the two investigations that you mentioned by the Inspector General and there was another one, did those investigations ever have any communication with the Detroit Free Press?
The OIG investigation did not communicate with the Detroit Free Press because it was an internal investigation of DOJ. And as a matter of practice, yeah, we don't.
I want to know.
That's right. So no, they would not have spoken to the Detroit Free Press.
That's one missing link here, right?
So the reason that I was bringing up Mr. Ashenfelter's Fifth Amendment privilege and the basis for it, simply to say that, you know, we know we have some information, and that statute has to do with stealing, purloining government records, taking or converting records without consent. We have Mr. Ashenfelter's deposition in which he says that he has never revealed the source to anyone, indicating that he hasn't told anyone at the Detroit Free Press who the source is. We have multiple statements from the Detroit Free Press, it was perfectly appropriate for Judge Lamberth here in D.C. to credit those. There was no requirement that he, although he might not have jurisdiction to decide an issue, it was certainly appropriate for him to determine in making his futility determination for purposes of how to deal with the 56F motion, to note that the Detroit Free Press had said repeatedly, consistently, that it didn't have the information. Now, Your Honor, Judge Tatel noted earlier that the paper has said that it has some documents, you know, or has said that it would be willing to turn over whatever documents it has about this article. Now, it's never indicated that it has anything relating to the source. It's said consistently the opposite.
No, but it did say.
It simply said it would turn over whatever it had. And the fact that.
No, it said if it would narrow it to XX and anything about the source. It says that.
Right, it's taking the language of Mr. Convertino's request and saying if you'll narrow it to just the January 2004 article, we'll turn over everything you've requested. They're not saying they have anything that meets those criteria, but that they'll turn over whatever they have. And I'm not suggesting that I would doubt that they have something because it is a newspaper. The chance that they have copy edit seems quite likely.
Let me just read this to you. It says I'm reading from the Free Press's opposition, which is a joint appendix 131, says that if the plaintiff will narrow the subpoena to documents relating to the preparation, publication, or sources of the article, it will produce them.
Right, but that phrase that ends with sources is language from Mr. Convertino's subpoena request. So it's repeating that.
It's used by the Free Press.
Well, but it's not to say that they have that material. Elsewhere, they have said consistently that they have nothing.
But we're going in circles. They've never said that under oath, and they use the word source here. You would have.
Right. I think unless there are further questions, the government's view in this case is that all of this information that we've discussed, the timeline, the things that were filed by Mr. Convertino, the failure to follow up with the court in the Eastern District of Michigan, the failure to make any effort to amend the timeline in the District of Columbia, all of that was before Judge Lamberth. And the abuse of discretion standard with Rule 56F motions has never suggested that it would be an abuse by the district court to take all of that into account and to determine that, as Judge Lamberth concluded, there was simply no reason to believe that Mr. Convertino would, moving forward, obtain the information that he needed.
I do have one question. You say you're not relying on the Rule 60B aspect of his order.
That's right.
Excise parts of his decision? In other words, if that was clearly wrong.
Well, I mean, this court can affirm on any grounds appropriate. It need not agree with every.
The court says, suggesting, I'm not denying the plaintiff any opportunity whatsoever to pursue his litigation because if he gets evidence, he can come back and file a Rule 60B motion. Well, that's clearly wrong.
That is clearly wrong, but we think the court's conclusion is clearly supportable by this record.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Does Mr. Cohn have any time?
Mr. Cohn did not have.
All right, if you need it, 2 minutes. I
hope you'll address this scheduling issue that counsel relied on.
Yes, Your Honor. The motion to enlarge deadlines was just a motion to enlarge deadlines, including discovery deadlines that had been set. And it was a joint motion. The plaintiff filed it because the government asked us to, but all the deadlines were agreed and negotiated by the parties. So they're essentially trying to make a big issue of what was just a scheduling deadline. Everyone knew the court wanted a hard date for summary judgment. Everyone knew the court wanted a hard date for cutting off discovery. And everyone knew that regardless of those dates, the discovery in the Eastern District was permitted to go forward, even when discovery got cut off in D.C., and everybody knew that there was a potential Rule 56F motion if the government chose to rely upon our inability to identify the source in its summary judgment motion.
And your reason for not going back to the Eastern District at that point to alert?
I mean, in the words of Resolution Trust v. Northbridge, they says you don't need to whip a dead horse. There were interlocutory appeals had been filed, motions to expedite. I flew up to the Eastern District probably four or five times. That court knew all the issues, and I think this case, Resolution Trust, it really talks to this delay and Rule 56F issue, because it talks about a reluctant opponent. And this court in First Chicago International talked about the actions of a defendant or a deponent in delaying discovery. The fact that the witnesses here resisted lawfully and that we were required to jump through many hoops, that doesn't in any way impact our rights under Rule 56F. And in fact, the case law all cuts the other way. And the policy that you shouldn't reward a reluctant witness cuts the other way.
How do you respond to government counsel's argument that the reporter testified that he never told anybody at the Free Press who the source was?
The key issue with the Detroit Free Press are the documents, and which there's an extensive privilege log from Ashenfelter. He was communicating to them, and the Detroit Free Press has documents. The second issue, so we've never seen a privilege log, we've never seen a document. Second, the Detroit Free Press does not have a Fifth Amendment privilege as to those documents. So emails going back and forth to that newspaper, we can discover them from the Detroit Free Press.
You mean there might be circumstantial evidence?
Yeah, at a minimum circumstantial, but also the court also, we had a very specific motion on Rule 30b-6 and what type of witness the Detroit Free Press would have to call. And even if they recalled Ashenfelter, based upon his communications with the Detroit Free Press, there may have been additional arguments about waiver of the Fifth Amendment, depending on what the Detroit Free Press had. Mm-hmm. These are complex discovery issues in a hotly contested case about subpoenaing a journalist. And they were all before the Eastern District. Thank you very much, Your Honor. Thank you.